Hello to my fellow aliens, ghosts, and robots. It's Keith. Hello, and welcome back. I just want to give you a bit of news before we move on to the episode. This coming week, as I'm recording this, September 26th through the 29th, I will be visiting New Jersey for the New Jersey Web Fest, there to represent one of my other shows, The Love Talker. The Love Talker is up for 3 awards, nominated in the audio fiction categories for Outstanding Horror Thriller, Best Writing, and Best Supporting Actor, and I'm really looking forward to attending and being in such wonderful company and among other talented people. If you're going to be there, come say hi. And if you haven't heard The Love Talker, I do suggest you check it out. It's a folk horror piece, and it's also got a fantastic cast and a wonderful score written by M.T. Goins, who was my collaborator. You can go to thelovetalker.com to check it out. All right, here's today's episode. An Invisible Sun by W. Keith Timms. Chapter 9. Back in the departure lounge, not much had changed. There were a few more passengers waiting, and the attendant behind her elevated desk stood alone there, busy with her screen. My skin still crawled from when I'd been spotted by the tattooed man. Perhaps it was an overreaction, but I felt like I was on the cusp of something I shouldn't know. Something illegal or esoteric, and that feeling of being out of my depth clung to me like a weight. I approached the desk. After a moment, the attendant looked up and smiled at me indulgently, but not authentically. She didn't say anything, simply waited for me to speak.
Hello again. Sorry. This is my first gate flight, and I'm curious. I saw the line of people outside, the expatriation line. I was wondering where that ship was going.
Her expression barely changed, only mild confusion there in her eyes for a moment. It was, I think, a question she had never been asked to answer.
I think most of those ships go to Mars. If not as their final destination, then to use the ring hub to the outer solar system. Oh, yes, I see. Is there any way of knowing where that particular ship is going? The one out there right now?
Another flicker of confusion crosses her face, though her smile seems immune.
I don't have that information. Why?
I'd pushed too hard. With a shake of my head, I backed away and waved her question off.
Just curious, that's all. Thank you anyway.
She reconnected with her rehearsed concern.
I'm sorry, I can't help you with that.
And as I retreated, she turned back to her screen. I slunk to a chair, facing the window with the shuttle beyond, and sat, trying to look inconspicuous without looking like I was trying to be inconspicuous. Outside, I watched technicians in protective suits doing some sort of maintenance on the shuttle, while other ships crisscrossed in the sky. I heard footsteps approaching the desk, and the rolling wheels of luggage muffled by the carpeting.
Welcome back, Ms. Reynolds.
There, checking in at the desk, was the woman in the green pantsuit I had collided with earlier.
Just the one bag this trip?
She didn't even look up. The agent capped off their exchange with another,
"Okay, you're all set."
She walked away from the counter as if the agent didn't exist. She had the air of a seasoned traveler for whom all the majesty and wonder of the gateport is now just background noise. She took a chair a few down from me, casually parking her luggage. There's something about her poise which reassured me. Someone who knows what they're doing. She looked to be near my age, early 40s, though was much more fit and tanned than I.
Hello again.
She squinted at me, taking off her sunglasses to get a better look.
It only took a few seconds for realization to dawn, and she gave me a little smile that revealed the beginnings of laugh lines around her eyes.
Oh, we meet again. Small world, huh?
Yes, seems like. Again, sorry about earlier.
It's okay,
she said, tucking strands of her brown hair behind her ears.
If I don't get run over at least twice in the gateport, I think something's wrong with the world.
Yes, well, it is a bit crowded, isn't it? Not my scintillating best. I am out of practice with small talk. She studied me thoughtfully, weighing options and reaching a conclusion.
First time?
Yes, I'm afraid so. Does it show? She sent another faint, cryptic grin my way.
Not too badly. You don't look like you're about to pass out, at least.
Her voice is casual and warm, like a comfortable sweater.
I make this trip every few months. Really, the shuttle is a lot like a regular airplane. And once we're docked with the Starliner, you can get up and walk around. It's nice.
I read up on the process before coming, but I guess that's a lot different than actually doing it.
The hardest thing to get used to is the low gravity. Just don't be embarrassed if you throw up. It happens to a lot of people the first time.
Did it with you? She was amused.
Well, no.
Well, now I have to live up to your example.
If you need me to hold your hair back, I will. Let's hope it doesn't come to that.
In truth, considering how I've been feeling the last few weeks, throwing up is quite possible. But I wasn't going to tell her that.
So, you said you make this trip all the time. What do you do?
I'm in sales.
Oh, what sort of things do you sell?
Her little smile turned to a wry smirk.
I'm the vice president of sales for a company that manufactures erotic goods and entertainments.
I certainly didn't expect that.
Oh,
is all I managed. I am not a prude. To be honest, romance and sex have always been something of a mystery to me. It's not that I find anything wrong with it, I just don't think about it often. But I wished I'd had a better answer. I didn't want to put her off. She laughed at me, though it wasn't mocking or unkind.
I always get two reactions from people when I tell them that. Either they go, oh, like you just did, or they start hitting on me. I'm sorry. Would you prefer the other? No, thank you. Besides, it's just work. Men outnumber women 3-1 on Mars. We do very well. And I get to travel all over the planet, meeting clients, setting up contracts, arranging for holosuite entertainment centers, and then I come home.
She gestured to her luggage.
I have my samples with me. That's a lot of fun and security. I have an apartment on Mars with clothes and essentials, so I can travel light. Not too bad as jobs go.
I suppose it's not, is it? She held out her hand.
I'm Catherine, by the way. Catherine Reynolds.
We shook.
Christopher Cousins.
She gave my hand a reassuring squeeze.
You'll be fine on the trip, Christopher. You'll see.
Her camaraderie was pleasant and surprising. I began realizing just how isolated I'd made myself over the last few years. Did the world do that to me? Or did I do that to myself? I can't remember the last time someone held my hand, even as innocent as this was.
I think I'll be fine. I saw there's an observation deck. That ought to keep my attention. The view of Earth is pretty nice the first few times you see it. But Twine Drive travel is a disappointment.
Why is that? She shrugs.
Because there's nothing to see.
Abruptly, the agent's chipper voice came over the speakers in the departure lounge. I don't know why she bothered. The lounge is small enough, and the dozen or so passengers were right in front of her.
We're now prepared to board Carillon Shuttle 130 with service to Sheo Starliner 7 for Twine Drive to Mars. Please gather your belongings for final boarding procedures. Thank you for choosing Carillon, and enjoy your flight.
Catherine smirked at me and murmured,
We're sitting right in front of her.
Together, we got up and were shown into the shuttle by the agent and her plastic smile. The inside of the Carillon shuttle was bright and a little bit cramped. It reminded me of an ordinary airplane cabin, though instead of seats, there were plush and contoured acceleration couches. The steward helped me strap down my luggage and showed me how to fasten the five-point harness that secured me to the couch. Catherine settled into one next to me, strapping herself in easily. But the rest of the cabin seemed disappointingly familiar. Perhaps the shuttle trip will be far more mundane than I anticipated. On takeoff, however, that notion left my head. Nothing prepared me for the bone-rattling roar of the engines and the fierce acceleration as the silver shuttle lowered its wings and left the surface behind. In a blink, we arced up through the atmosphere, bumping and shaking the whole way. I gripped the armrests of the seat, as if it were my fingers, not the straps, that kept me from being torn from the couch and lost forever. Gradually, though, the roar of the engines grew quieter, though the vibration of them never goes away. The turbulence faded as well, and the pressure of acceleration eased. A hand touches mine. It's Catherine, and she's grinning at my pale, stricken face and the death grip on the upholstery.
The worst part is over. You can relax now. Look, we're in orbit.
Glancing out of the window next to me, the sky was black and decorated with stars, and so many of them. Down on the surface, the haze and lights of the metro kept all but the brightest from shining through, even on a clear night. I knew the stars were hidden, but to actually see them, to get a glimpse of the infinite number of them, not in a video or photo, but arrayed around me in all directions. It's like the Earth had been keeping the universe a secret from me all these years. The shuttle banked, and the moon rolls slowly into view, half in shadow. Luna glimmers like a needlessly bejeweled and decorated pearl. On its night side, the great opalescent pyramid of the Prima Luna Resort outshines the other glittery lights around it. A tacky and unnecessary ornament.
What do you think? It's astonishing. No wonder you love to travel. It's nice, yes. But like everything else, eventually you take it for granted. I understand what you mean, but I don't think I could ever get tired of this.
Just being here, with my past down below, too small to see from orbit, gave me a strange sort of hope.
Hey, you should be able to see the gate soon.
As if on cue, the ship banked into another turn. The Earth appeared again, her thin layer of atmosphere dense with gray haze. For a moment, I didn't see the gate. But then, there it was. A vast, brass-colored ring floating in space, far over the Earth. A perfectly round impossibility, impossibly placed. It's confusing to look at. One can't quite get the scale of it. There's nothing to compare it to.
Where's the Starliner?
Catherine craned her head to get a better view out of my window.
Do you see that little pinkish dot of light?
I must strain to see it, a tiny mote near the ring.
That's it? That's the Starliner? Yes, and that little cluster of silver dots? That's Shayot Gate Control.
The true scale of what I saw was terrifying. Shayot Gate Control is a small floating city, the biggest orbital station around Earth, home to thousands of workers and serving hundreds of ships a day. But next to the gate itself, that station becomes a few specks of light. The gate is 1,600 kilometers across, a ring that, if laid upon the Earth, would surround Texas. I have read about the gates and Twine Drive and knew whatever the layman's explanation was for how it works. But faced with it in person, I could not fathom the amount of work and resources spent building a single ring, nor the complex science necessary to set it into precise motion, nor the vast energy requirements necessary for its operation. And there are hundreds of rings drifting through the solar system in a precise ballet, curving gently upwards over the plane of the ecliptic and back down again in easy parabolas. Tunnels in the sky. Launch rings and booster rings, aligned seriatim, all directing and maintaining the mysterious energy wave of the twine drive upon which the ship surfed at near the speed of light. The Earth had surrendered completely to the promise of Shayot. Freedom from the moribund planet and its inevitable decline. Before the gates, only the most daring or most desperate would subject themselves to the long route to Mars. With years of preparation and months of travel, now making the trip is commonplace by comparison. A few hours at most. Maybe Catherine was right after all. Maybe in time, miracles become mundane. The shuttle turned abruptly. I felt us slowing down rapidly, and a view screen showed us on approach to the Starliner, bullet-shaped, though wasp-waisted, and marked with stripes of gold and violet that trailed dramatically from the nose. Affixed to its narrow waist were two huge struts that attached the monstrous twine-drive skids to the ship. Almost as long as the ship itself, the backs of these metal panels shone with diffused and reflected sunlight in odd colors. From what I have read, these skids will catch the energy wave generated by the gate, as a sail might the wind, or as water skis might an ocean swell. The twine drive itself on the ship somehow sutures the vessel to the wave. That's the word the pundits use, sutures, carrying it along at just below light speed. I do not understand the science. Most people don't. It was perhaps the biggest secret in history. The Starliner constantly rotated to simulate gravity inside, and along its hull there were rows of dimple-like docking ports for the shuttles. The shuttles used the Starliner as a mothership, riding snug in these bays, and then will release from it and fly on their way once we reach Mars. Suddenly we were docking. I felt a sharp burst of deceleration, and the shuttle's engines whined and vibrated through the walls. We rolled and disappeared into the shadow of the Starliner, and we bumped gently to a halt. The engines cut out, and the cabin went quiet. Catherine was already unstrapping herself and reaching for her satchel.
Ready to go aboard? Just be careful, we're in low gravity now.
I almost flew off my couch as I undid my harness. I felt remarkably light, and every motion was effortless, like I'd been laden with chains all my life and suddenly had them lifted. My body didn't ache as much, at least.
I think I could get used to this. It's the same on Mars.
She moved down the aisle to the exit airlock that the steward was opening.
1/3 gravity. If you get too used to it, you won't be able to go back to Earth. I once stayed on Mars for 6 months, and even with exercise in a 1G gym, I could barely walk.
I tried to follow, finding myself bouncing against the ceiling from walking too vigorously. It takes me a moment to regain my footing.
So, listen, I'm going to find the observation lounge. Do you want to get something to drink?
She gave me a knowing smile, and I hastened to add,
No, not like that. I have not crossed over into hitting on you territory. These are purely platonic drinks on offer.
Her grin was kind and understanding.
Thanks. I hear Plato mixes a mean cocktail. But I'm going to find a vacant workstation and use Earth network access before we hit Twine Drive. I'll see you back here when we get to Mars, okay? Sure. Okay.
I found myself disappointed that she was going.
Have fun. Enjoy the view.
And then she was ascending the ladder with casual ease, gliding hand over hand before she vanished through the hatch. I envied her grace and confidence. It was a short, gliding walk, heavily relying on handrails, to the fore of the Starliner. Passengers such as I could only go that way anyway. The aft of the ship was guarded by a sturdy, unmarked hatch, and a woman in a Shayat uniform standing at parade rest. She smiled politely, but she is an immobile barrier and keeps careful watch. The observation lounge reminded me of a posh hotel. A few dozen people relaxed among its numerous cozy tables and booths. The lights were low, coming from little luminaries at the tables and a floating chandelier of spheres overhead. The great observation window takes up the entire nose of the ship, and the stars outside turned slowly in the heavens as the ship rotated to simulate a little gravity. I found a table away from other people, careful not to go flying. The liner's luxury surrounded me, welcomed me. The real wood tables. The soothing music. The discreet menu screen that lights up as I sat in the very comfortable chair. I found myself slowly relaxing. Tension draining from my shoulders that I hadn't been aware of. The lounge suddenly brightens. The Earth rotated into view through the window, and I saw my home like I have never seen before. It's astonishing how blue the ocean looks when peaks of it appear from under the cloud cover. The glitter of thousands of orbiting objects gives the world a costume jewelry shininess. A massive storm was scouring Latin America. I could just make out the bare peaks of the Appalachians, rusty red and black, long since stripped of trees, poking up through the swirl of yellow smog. And there was, of course, the gray blight of the metro, clinging to the encroaching edge of the Atlantic like some overwrought Baroque border. Somewhere down there is my tiny apartment and my tiny office. And for the first time in recent memory, I was not trapped in either of them.
"Can I get you something?"
asked a steward in a black and purple uniform. I smiled.
"Yes, I would love a cup of coffee."
The coffee was excellent. I also ordered a hydroponically grown watercress sandwich for a ridiculous price, but it was fantastic. I had the whole table to myself. No one bothered me. No one crowded me. The menu screen turned into a news feed for me to browse with a leisure I have not felt in a long time. Was it the luxury? The freedom? The distance from my troubles, so tiny, down there below me? This feeling was intoxicating, perhaps even dangerous. I had, momentarily, forgotten about my illness, about Evan's strange behavior, about the whispered conspiracies. And in forgetting, I feel content. What would I trade to keep this feeling? What morals and responsibilities would I overlook to remove my worries forever, had I the money to do so? A metallic chime filled the air. People around me turned expectantly toward the window, so I did too. The Starliner's engines cut out, and their background rumble went away, leaving the piped-in jazz, the clink of cocktail glasses, and murmured conversation as the only sounds left. For a moment, nothing happened. Then came a flash of violet light that I felt in my flesh, like sunburn in my veins. The ship rocked as if something bumped it. And when the light faded, the stars were gone. Nothing but blackness appeared beyond the great window, save for an indistinct violet glow far ahead. I felt no sense of motion, no feeling of acceleration, heard no sound of engines, and yet, that must have been Twine Drive. I watched the window for a while, but nothing disturbed the featureless black and the haze of violet. Most of the other passengers turned back to their drinks and conversation. Catherine had been right. Twine Drive, once underway, was rather boring. The last dregs of my coffee have gone cold. Presumably, the cargo ship that Sister Lucy and her companions had boarded would be airborne soon, if not already, making their way to the gate just as I had. Why hadn't they taken the Starliner? Why the riskier, cramped passage? Surely not because of the cost. The only other answer that came to me was that they were traveling under assumed names, avoiding the more rigorous security of the Starliner, which meant they were in hiding. They didn't want to be tracked or followed. Was Mars their final destination? If so, where were they going? And what did Evan have to do with them? The man at the Eyes of the World meeting had said Evan was involved with higher ups in this Invisible Sun organization. Did that mean Sister Lucy? Were they coming to help him? Or was it them he was running from? The ship shuddered under me, like a car skimming over a patch of ice and then finding traction. The black and violet void outside evaporates like fog, and the stars return. Hanging low in the window was the rusty orange disk of Mars. The Starliner's engines roared to life again, and the whole lounge vibrated and lurched lightly.
Attention, passengers. We have arrived at our destination and are currently maneuvering out of the gate. Shuttle launches will begin in approximately 20 minutes. Welcome to Mars.
I tried to appreciate the experience of arriving at another planet for the first time. It was impressive, seeing something so alien with one's own eyes. An expanse of desert and dust, with a more distant sun casting a rim of light over one horizon. But I couldn't stay. I couldn't focus. I felt the pain in my joints, heard the dull roar of blood rushing in my ears. All this luxury was a trap, and ultimately not comfort enough to hold me. I returned to the shuttle, early. The same woman in the neat Shayot uniform guarded the hatch to the back of the ship. I noticed this time, as I went down the ladder, that she wore a sidearm. It feels like she watches my every move until I am inside. An Invisible Sun is written, produced, performed, and composed by W. Keith Timms, and is a production of Alien Ghost Robot Creative Media. If you're enjoying the story, please tell your friends and family about it, and leave stars or reviews on your favorite podcast platforms. I hope you'll join us on our Discord server, or sign up for our mailing list so we can stay in touch. Members of our Patreon get to hear future episodes early, plus other cool perks for all our shows. Go to InvisibleSunPod.com for more information.